Welcome to the weekend edition of the Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. On today's program, we got a lot to cover, as always, and looking forward to introducing you to today's guests. But in addition to that, I do want to mention that the Price of Business, which is one of the longest-running business shows in the country, continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com. We are adding new content all the time. There you can see all of our regular guests. We have reoccurring guests from Fox Business, from Yahoo Finance, gentlemen like Cody Willard, who was a longtime CNBC and Fox Business anchor. He's on this program every single week. And so we're excited by the talent that we bring you. Also, I do want to mention I've got a book called Making New Rich Books Work for You, and exclusively for our listeners of this program. It's available at a ridiculously low price. If you want to get more information about that, go to priceofbusiness.com. If you read anything by people like Tim Ferriss or Robert Kiyosaki, who's been on my show many, many times, and you know, really were excited but had little to show for it when you try to pursue those things, my book explains why. There's something going on, and the problem really isn't with these authors. It's usually with the reader. And you can get more information about that at priceofbusiness.com. With that, here's our first guest right here on The Price of Business. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. Love my conversations with Hassan Persevan, longtime regular on the program. He's an attorney who focuses on labor law in particular, and this brings great insight to every conversation, and I love something we have gotten, and I think a good habit of doing, is tying his work to what we read in the headlines, and boy, do we have something today that ties in well with the headlines. It really was shocking, the impact that Andy Byron indiscretion at a Coldplay concert had. The ripple effect has been extraordinary and has really raised questions, and I think, unfortunately, some of the wrong questions. I'd like to see the kind of conversation we're going to have this segment rather than the pure speculation and the ooh-ah shock and that type of thing. And no one better to talk to than Hassan Persevan. Hassan, welcome as always. A little bit about your firm real quick and your best website, and then we're going to jump right into this topic.
Sure. Yeah, the best website is parsfirm.com, P as in Patrick, A-R-Z as in zebra, F-I-R-M.com. And the practice is mainly in the labor and employment space, both advising employers and employees.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great work, and always love the insight you bring from that work. Okay, so you had a CEO of a company on a day, obviously, because they were making out with an employee of all employees, the HR director. Boy, you talk about picking poorly in this, poor judgment on one or two people's parts, and going to a concert, a Coldplay concert, which I envy them for that alone. I'm a huge Coldplay fan, and deciding to make out during the kiss cam portion, and they were caught. Videos were made by at least one individual who sent it out into social media, and within hours, really at least a couple of days, you had one of them, the CEO, resigning, and both of them were under investigation. They discontinued the CEO's investigation because of the fact that he resigned. Why bother? But the HR director is looking for trouble. She was married, but not to the guy. and he was divorced, and so I guess that in his mind that made it okay. But let's face it, when you're talking corporations, and the Sperber is a pretty sizable corporation, they have pretty strict rules about these kind of behaviors. It's not.
No doubt, and I mean, obviously, it's always an interesting line, kind of, in employment law, right? The issue isn't the consensual relationship, in the employment law context. Although in this particular case, when you're dealing with, upper echelon officers of the company, I think there's more of a for lack of a better way of putting it, like a modeling problem, right? And especially, you know, when there's also, you know, allegations of, you know, immorality, in that regard. But the issue, generally speaking, in employment law, when there is a relationship between coworkers, is when the breakup occurs, right?
Yes.
That's what the HR people kind of fear the most. I mean, in isolation, it's not illegal for, you know, a boss to be dating the employee. But when the breakup occurs, how can the boss possibly, you know, defend any action he would take against his former paramour? I think that's always the problem in employment law.
Yeah, no doubt about it, because, you know, did she or he, because, you know, you could have a boss who's female. We've seen that scenario. Did he or she want to end a relationship sooner, but feel coerced in staying longer? You know, what kind of actions took place to make the relationship as long as it was? You know, I mean, it's just, you know, if you wanted to look up in the dictionary the expression can of worms, and then look for examples, this would be one of them. it's a big can of worms.
No doubt. And yeah, I mean, I've had a case in recent memory, you know, involving the restaurant industry, and a subordinate female who is much younger, you know, dating the boss for a time period, and then, you know, a breakup occurred, and then, you know, the boss had a tendency to drink a lot at work, and seems like he couldn't, you know, he couldn't hold his emotions in after having a few drinks, as to how upset he was about the breakup. And so people are people, right? And emotions are emotions. But you know, for that individual that I represented, you know, that was, you know, severely uncomfortable, and ultimately, you know, we were able to resolve the matter.
Yeah, and so, in spite of the fact it is only in the breakup, just to be clear, it's not unusual policy. I'm assuming, particularly among bigger companies, to have pretty strict guidelines about who can and cannot date, and it's pretty prohibited, particularly among senior people, to those who are underlings.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are definitely, you know, companies frequently do have, you know, non-fraternization policies, and obviously that's another, you know, that's kind of another wrinkle in these situations, is those non-fraternization policies that, you know, sometimes I've gotten calls from potential clients who argue that, you know, the non-fraternization policies are not being kind of equally enforced, and, and they know of other relationships that are not being disclosed, and but that people know about, and things of that sort. So it's pretty messy. I mean, obviously, you know, you work with people for a long period of time. You know, people are humans, they're not cogs. There's a possibility that somebody likes somebody else. And I don't, like, in my view, right, I just don't see any policy truly being preventative of that occurrence. You know, now, obviously, people may go underground and not be open about their relationship or whatever, but I mean, in that situation, you know, people begin to notice, right? You know, it doesn't take very long for, you know, kind of the rumors to spread and for it to be, I mean, I think when two people are dating, it's almost impossible for it not to be obvious if, you know, they're spending 40 hours a week at work, you know, in the workplace together, to not show any bit of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Talk a little bit about what, how do you prevent this? I mean, to me, you kind of summed it up. You know, it's almost like an exercise in futility.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, and I mean, the reality is that, in terms of kiss cam scandals, I think this is number one ever, right? You know, like I don't remember in whatever, you know, social media, in my view, is roughly about 20 years old, right? But I don't remember at any point, you know, kind of like a kiss cam scandal getting this much traction ever. And I mean, like, I was really shocked to be honest with you on like how much like on my Facebook feed, like, you know, this appeared like at least like 4 to 10 times, you know. I don't want to, you know, and it was kind of shocking how much traction it actually got, you know. And so so that also you know is kind of interesting. I mean, it's not, this isn't like some frequent occurrence, and obviously like these people, like I don't think they would have ever guessed that, you know, they would be outed nationwide and have like late night talk show hosts talking about them and stuff like that, because I mean, essentially, you know, for purposes of the American media market, there were nobodies before this, right? You know,
And so to me, when I look at it, I think it was got the traction it got more for the lunacy and stupidity rather than for the act.
No doubt about it, and I mean, I guess, you know, I guess it shows, you know, like that your social media, if one kind of lesson, you know, your activities that are viewed on social media or viewed on media in general, because the line is blurring between social media and media anyway, are likely to affect your employment prospects. And so, for example, Mehdi Hassan had like a 1 versus 20 or something like that, him against, you know, 20 far right people. And there was one guy who flat out said, you know, he's a fascist, and he got fired from his job. And from what I understand, he started a GoFundMe for himself after getting fired, after, you know, the video came out of him arguing with Mehdi Hassan and saying, yeah, I am a fascist. So
and
anyway,
I don't even mind being called a Nazi. You said that too.
Oh, I saw that. I am a fascist. I didn't even know. I didn't know he even said that. But
yeah,
but anyway,
he said that too. Yeah, tens of thousands, in fact, he's gotten so far. Yeah, it's interesting. It, with a lot of encouraging, you know, go get him, Tiger. I mean, it's incredible, actually. Yeah, yeah. That would be a good future topic. We're running out of time, though. We're playing beat the clock on this one. Give us some final thoughts and takeaways, and how things could be done better, if that's even possible. There is a futility to all this.
Yeah, how could done better? I mean obviously in this case, you know, obviously these two individuals definitely they could have attended the Coldplay concert and not been caught in that position. They could have obviously not been in a relationship at all. But yeah, I mean, it's a very, very tricky area just in general, because humans are humans, and, you know, and ultimately I think they do have a tendency to fall for each other at work. I mean, it is a place where relationships do occur. And I know I know that there's a particular EV manufacturer that I have a bunch of friends at, and they joke that like there are corporate weddings of sorts that happen, you know, where I mean they're not funded by the corporation obviously, but like it's all alums and people who worked at that company who are attending the weddings, right? Because you know the people met at the company and you know obviously have strong relationships.
Yeah. And by the way, I may have misspoke. He was the one not divorced. She was divorced. I want to make sure I got that straight. Was in the process of getting a divorce. He was the one not divorced. And by 24 hours later, his wife's social media had dropped her married name. So things are moving very quickly. I think maybe the word is discretion. You're not going to prevent some of this happening, but you can be mature about it and adult about it. Look at the dynamics of the reality of what you're doing with this boyfriend or girlfriend, depending on what's happening here. Just think consequentially what happens next. And boy, if you ask the question of what happens if we get caught on a camera, because it's all over the place, or everyone's looking at the screen, what happens next? And I think most people would go, okay, we're going to be like buddies tonight. We're not going to be a couple. You know, it's just,
right.
Yeah, a little discretion. Got to end it with that. Hassam, your website one more time as we wrap it up.
Sure. ParsFirm.com, P as in Patrick, A-R-Z as in Zebra, F-I-R-M.com.
Hassam Parsivan, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Kevin Price. You are listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. It's a show that never ends. It continues 24-7 at PriceOfBusiness.com, where we're always adding new content, audio, video, articles, and more. Speaking of more, stay tuned for that right after this. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. Lee Kaplan, he's joining me. Always love my conversations with him. We talk about everything from the most macro global affairs to the most micro local governing and every level of government in between. He's really a phenomenal pundit because he's incredibly consistent and really puts reason as his number one mode of thinking. We may not always agree, but I agree with his approach, which is so refreshing in a world that's, to me, so dominated by things other than common sense. So, Lee, I always love having you on the program. Take just 1 minute, please, to talk about your practice and the best website for people to get more information.
Sure, and thank you for having me. I'm a trial lawyer, and my law firm is called Murphy Ball Stratton. It is a 10-lawyer firm, and we handle disputes of all kinds, trials, arbitrations, appeals, and, of course, things that go along with that, such as mediations and multiple hearings and arguments in front of judges and juries. All of our lawyers have worked for judges, and we understand the system inside out. We have cases in multiple states. And it's just fun. I enjoy being a lawyer and being known as a trial lawyer. Again, it's Murphy Ball Stratton.
I love it. Always love our conversations love what you bring as far as that experience. We're going to talk about what's going on with Donald Trump and the Epstein situation. For so long, you know, Trump had a pretty good hold on the tail. And all of a sudden, the tail, which is MAGA, is wagging the dog. And frankly, it's kind of refreshing. I'm glad to see it happening. He has tried so hard to put this genie in the bottle of, Epstein has been blown out of proportion. Yeah, mainly by Trump. This is a media conspiracy, it's a left-wing conspiracy, et cetera. But this demand, which I think is totally logical, I think it should be pursued, for more information on Epstein is crucial. And his base is really, Marjorie Taylor Greene said today, this stuff of getting getting documents of what was said by Epstein from the courts, that ain't enough. We want every single document that pertains to this. Trump doesn't want that, and it makes you wonder why.
Well, he can't help himself. I mean, he simply cannot say nothing. That's just too much. I mean, this is a tempest in a teapot. The president has done so many things that are so out there and ridiculous in recent months and years that you would think that some controversy about Epstein would be nothing and would disappear immediately. But having made it into a big deal, he can't seem to get out of his own way. And a lot of us are simply laughing about it. It is totally insignificant.
Oh, you think it's insignificant? I think there are names that, and I don't think they're on a list. I think looking at his Epstein's flight logs could have value. I think there's a lot of different routes that are worth pursuing. I personally think.
Absolutely, somebody might pursue them. But what are we going to learn about Donald Trump that we didn't know already? That he's treated women with fairly cavalier disregard for their own feelings, that he is mercurial, that he has enjoyed pursuing what I guess we could call pleasure, and that he likes to be in the limelight. So whatever he did with Epstein many years ago is, to my mind, irrelevant for what he is doing or will do as president. But it provides a little bit of a diversion, and perhaps we ought to focus on that and just enjoy it.
Yeah, I think so. So what do you get? I'm gathering by your comment that that you're thinking this is going to be a whole lot of nothing in the end except for drama along the way.
Well, no, not nothing, because in a way it shows us just how insignificant and frivolous these controversies are. And it's kind of a signpost or another mile marker in the Trump odyssey. But I don't think it's going to make any difference to policy. I don't think it will make Vladimir Putin more insignificant. I don't think the Ukraine war will go away. I don't think the deficit will be affected. So it's just one more thing that we can enjoy for a little while. It's a diversion and should remind us exactly how irrelevant all of those things are.
Yeah. And I think, ironically, you know, his what she calls the most consequential president ever. Yeah. I think he's incredibly consequential, to be perfectly honest with you, Lee, but not in a good way. Consequent list. I mean, you know, he has rechanged, he's reshaped the way Americans think about leadership, of what a president can and cannot do, rule of law. None of that is good.
Well, I agree. You know, in that, it was interesting that Obama and Biden were a respite from the early Trump years. But now we've got another Trump term, and assuming he doesn't try to get another 4 years out of this, I don't know whether people will revert back to the old mean or not. Having done this twice now, it may be that the most outrageous or the most wayward candidates will be the ones who will get all the attention, and our next president might well be in the Trump mode, because we tried one time reverting from the old Trump and his outrageous 4 years, and then we got the new Trump, who frankly is even more outrageous than the old Trump. So I don't know whether he's setting the standard for future presidents or not. I hope not
too, but I'm afraid he probably has.
And I think the media is you know, frankly, partially at least, guilty in all this. The media really suffered financially under boring Biden. They really did. They took a beating. And Trump has given people a reason to watch the news and to consume the news again. And you know, for all the wrong reasons. I mean, simply put,
well, that's right.
For all the wrong reasons.
You know, we need something to talk about, and this is the example. It also diverts us from some of our real problems, and nobody really wants to talk about things like immigration or the deficit or the war in Ukraine. They'd rather spend more time on Trump's peccadilloes and misadventures, even
yes,
the ones that are 15, 20 years old or 30.
Yeah, 30 years. Hard to believe. Time goes fast, even when you're not having fun. So you, so what do you think are some of the? I think you've kind of laid out the takeaways. The takeaways is that America should be majoring in the majors and not in the gossip and in the drama.
We've become unserious, very unserious.
Yeah, very. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, so often when I hear people talk about Trump, including Trump supporters, half the time they're laughing about what Trump does. You know, it's like, hey, can you believe he did dot, dot, dot? And it's like, yeah, no, I can't believe it. I can't believe you think that's good. You know, and that's really what we come to. There's a movie, I think I've mentioned it to you before, and I have mentioned it many times over the years, you know, on the show, called Idiocracy. And, you know, Idiocracy, what used to be funny, that's a movie about a future time in which the most brilliant man in the world, IQ-wise, when he went into a frozen state for like 30 years, was average IQ. Well, you know, and the whole country, the whole planet is completely very Trump world-like, to be perfectly honest with you. Lee, and you know, that used to be a comedy. Idiocracy used to be a comedy. More and more, it feels like a documentary. It really does.
Well, you know, we are only 6 months into this term. We've got another 3.5 years of more events and more headlines and more diversions to see what happens. So, whether people will be completely inured to that, whether they'll hunger for more, whether they'll feel a sense of loss if this kind of stuff departs from the scene, it's hard to know. My personal hope is that we have a yearning to return to the norm, presidents of some level of dignity and judgment and common sense. But I would say, based on the evidence so far, that might be a forlorn hope.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's very romantic thinking these days, and that's very sad. Lee Kaplan, thanks so much for being with us. I am Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business. Stay tuned for more after this.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. It's your business to know about the law and how it's affecting every aspect of your life. It's your business to know about what's happening that's really important in the media front, particularly as it relates to the law. And so that's why I'm really excited about John O'Connor joining our media team here. He'll be doing reoccurring commentaries on business, the law, the political front, and the media. And we're delighted to have him join us. He's distinguished in the legal profession. He is an experienced trial lawyer practicing law in San Francisco since the early 70s. And he has tried cases in state and federal courts throughout the country. He served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Northern California, representing the United States in both criminal and civil cases. But he may be best known for his work as the attorney of Mark Felt, whom most of you know as Deep Throat in the Watergate situation. And he became very familiar with the role of the Washington Post in Watergate in his representation of Mark Felt. And so he brings a lot of experience. He also wrote briefs regarding Pat Hearst, United States versus Patty Hearst, and really had himself involved in some of the biggest lawsuits of the 20th century, representing the federal government in the vast majority of those cases. So we're delighted to have him. He's going to be bringing his interesting insights every other week here on the Price of Business show. You can learn more about him and his work at postgatebook.com. That's postgatebook.com. And that's the name of the book that he talks about most often. It relates to media, Postgate. And again, that's postgatebook.com. All right, with that, John O'Connor.
Thanks, Kevin. The Price of Business has asked me to speak about the FBI's prohibited access documents. We now face a political scandal that encompasses all other recent wrongdoing, and as a result, brings those others back anew. That scandal is best called prohibited access. It was only recently discovered that the FBI's information system, called Sentinel, had a level of access not known previously to anyone outside the Bureau, and apparently known only to a few inside the Bureau. In essence, it was a carefully concealed part of the system to in turn conceal documents that the FBI did not wish to be known as existing. To begin, there was one part of the FBI's Sentinel system, which was devoted to various levels of classified information, termed in total restricted access. As this name suggests, the information therein was accessible only to those with proper level clearances as appropriate to obtain the information at various levels within this tranche. But this restricted access level did not contain, as one would expect, all restricted information. To summarize, until recently, a government official outside the FBI and most agents inside the FBI did not know that restricted access did not contain all restricted levels of information. In turn, it has now been discovered that there was a yet higher and more secretive level of access called prohibited access. To any outside observer or investigator, there is no record, no indication that this information level exists. Thus, if one does a search for, say, Joe Biden, the system would show the title of documents throughout the system, unclassified, secret, top secret, and so forth, including references to restricted access documents. But it would not, underline not, show that there were prohibited access documents as well that would be responsive to the query. Accordingly, when special prosecutors like John Durham or congressional investigators such as Congressman James Comer were investigating various suspected misdeeds, they would not know of the existence of these documents. While it is yet unclear, the reasonable supposition exists that even Inspector General Michael Horowitz, in charge of overseeing the entirety of the FBI's conduct, did not know about this document cache in prohibited access. The alternative suspicion is that Horowitz may have indeed known about these concealed files, but he himself may not have mentioned them to the outside. Since one of Horowitz's function is to inform both Congress and the public about any issues within the FBI, if Horowitz did know about this prohibited access, that would be seriously problematic because he did not tell anyone about it. Logic tells us that there's only one motive for this concealment. It does not prevent, for example, one in the know, such as Director James Comey, from accessing documents in this tranche, but prevents those investigating the FBI or its favored parties to learn about these documents. So this concealment protects not only the FBI and its favored parties from inculpatory evidence, that is, evidence of their guilt, but also protects others from learning of exculpatory information. If, as a wild supposition, James Comey and Andrew McCabe broke laws to make an innocent Donald Trump appear guilty, they would not wish a trail of their ugly misconduct to ever see the light of day. What possible misdeeds of Comey, his inner circle, and his political favorites, like, for example, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, might prohibited access documents illuminate? If we were to be complete, this would be a very long discussion. But let us recall that Biden fired a prosecutor in Ukraine who was investigating his son Hunter's wealthy corrupt clients, which in turn encompassed the group Burisma Holdings and their principals Mykola Zlachevsky and Igor Kolomoisky. After the firing of the honest prosecutor, the prosecutions of Burisma and its agents were taken over by a new group called the National Bureau of Corruption in Ukraine. I think it's the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, called NABU. And NABU took over the cases against Burisma and its principals, and they were settled for nothing with no criminal charges filed. So NABU completed the whitewash, which would have nailed Hunter Biden's clients and perhaps Vice President Biden. Few also know that James Comey was able to place an agent within NABU and essentially have a voice in controlling NABU. What would prohibited access documents tell us about this chapter? Now, of course, we all know about Russiagate and how Hillary Clinton invented that false narrative with the ball carried by the FBI thereafter in the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. Early on, Special Agent Gaeta in London learned that Christopher Steele was working for Hillary Clinton's campaign. And early on, John Brennan's CIA even reported that it was a Hillary Clinton program and reported it to the Oval Office with James Comey in attendance on July 5th, 2016. Thereafter, however, Comey's FBI sought a warrant on the basis that Trump was seeking to torpedo Hillary Clinton's campaign, not vice versa, which she was doing. When the FBI moved the FISA court for a warrant to investigate the entirety of the Trump campaign, did Comey know that there was a false application because of his knowledge of connection to the Hillary Clinton campaign? He has denied knowing about that, saying, "This doesn't ring a bell." Let's stop here. There's every reason to believe the prohibited access documents will show misdeeds, perhaps criminal ones, on the basis of upper-level FBI officials and the parties they seek to protect, while at the same time entrapping Donald Trump and some of his agents who, in fact, were prosecuted on the basis of Comey's entrapments, like George Papadopoulos and Michael Flynn. Of course, to the extent that these documents have been classified, public access to them may be limited, and we may not know the whole truth in a public forum very soon. But stay tuned. This could be the scandal of all scandals.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. Really delighted always to have on my program David Walker, the former Comptroller General of the United States. He was the guy who was called to keep track of the nation's finances, a very important position that, frankly, during his tenure, he made it even more important. He gave it a vitality and a relevancy that was transformative. David, always glad to have you on the program. A little bit before we get started on your book, which is such an important book, such a timely topic, before we get into our topic today.
Well, my latest book, I've had four, but my latest one is America in 2040, Still a Superpower? A Pathway to Success. It was published in September of 2020. It's available through Amazon. There's a website, AmericaIn2040.com, which one can also go to. It deals with economic security, national security, domestic tranquility issues. It's interesting, Kevin. Right now I'm in the process of writing an update for what all's transpired since the book was published in September of 2020 through July of 2025. It's amazing what all has happened, but it's also amazing what hasn't happened. No meaningful steps have been taken to put our finances in order, and we're closer and closer to a debt crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like this administration's answer is to eliminate a debt ceiling.
Raised it $5 trillion, which gets them past the midterms. Doesn't get them past the end of the administration, but does get them past the midterms.
Yeah, very important to him. It's so weird when you think about it. You know, I was involved in a grassroots campaign in 1980
to prevent it from going to $1 trillion. You probably remember that campaign. And how, what was that, 1788 to 1980 to get to our first trillion? Every few months.
Well, and now we're approaching 37 trillion and rising quickly. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Okay, we had a nice list of things we could talk about. We narrowed it down to Musk's third party, which got a little play, kind of interesting. Musk gets a lot of play just because he's Musk. I've really struggled with him. He's very transactional, in my opinion, as is the president. I think a lot of his problems with Trump has to do how it affects his bottom line with Tesla. I have no doubt about that. But we need competition. I think the reason why we have such poor choices is that we live in a binary world in the United States. You know, I look at Canada, one-tenth the size of the United States, and they have five major parties, defining major as parties that can get people elected to their parliament. I look at Denmark, 6 million people in Denmark. They've got 15 major parties. Competition makes everything better, which is exactly why America is such a mess. And Musk is proposing a really, I think, logical choice in the third-party space, which is a highly focused, highly targeted approach in the House and the Senate. And this is something why talking to you, to me, is so valuable, because you're someone who is in the No Labels movement. Not only someone, you're one of the most biggest movers in that movement, and involved in its founding. So this is really right up your alley, David.
Well, I think that anybody's going to pay attention to what Musk wants to do, because he's got a track record of being innovative and being successful in the private sector. And he's, if not the richest person in the world, clearly one of the richest persons in the world. And therefore, he's got the financial resources to put behind whatever he might decide to do. My personal view is that the most effective strategy would be for him to partner with other organizations, such as No Labels, potentially the Ford Party and others, and to pick, let's say, no more than a handful of Senate races that could go either way, and to pick, no more than a dozen House races, be able to try to come up with candidates that will be attractive to the sensible center, which I think is at least 60% of the voting population, and to focus on a short list of issues that are important to the American people and that will resonate with the American people, which, among other things, would include putting our finances in order, would include immigration, would include other issues as well. And so, it'll be interesting to see how this, plays out. I do know that when No Labels was thinking about running a unity ticket in 2024 for president and vice president, which ultimately it didn't do, it identified 60 to 70 million voters who were not happy with either option and who wanted a third option and who were not satisfied with the direction of the country and the dysfunctionality of our current government. And so that database could be extremely invaluable to somebody like Musk if he decided he wanted to go and if he, agreed to employ a partnership approach.
Yeah. And actually abide by the partnership if he wins. That's always up there. You got to worry about that. But yeah, and when they do surveys of countries that are democratically based, the United States always ranks among the highest for dissatisfaction. And how can you blame them?
Well, as the countries that you mentioned before are parliamentary systems, right?
Right.
And our system is different in that regard. I do agree that competition is good, and we don't have enough competition now. I think in addition to fiscal reforms, which we talk about quite frequently, as well as other issues like immigration reform, education reform, et cetera, We need political reforms. I mean, my view is that we now have a republic, which is a representative democracy, that is not representative of nor responsive to the general public. We've got too many Republicans that are to the far right, too many Democrats that are to the far left, not enough people that are in the sensible center, center right, center left. Margins are very close, therefore every election's about control. People don't want to compromise on anything. And, you know, it's one thing if things are going well and things aren't getting done. It's another thing if things aren't going well and things aren't getting done. And all too frequently we find ourselves in that situation, especially with regard to our deteriorating financial condition.
Yeah, and that seems like it's been going on for decades, to be honest with you. I can't think of a real kumbaya time in the 21st century.
not in the 21st century. No, you're correct.
Yeah.
Other than after 9/11, okay, you know, the tragic events of 9/11, America comes together then. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. America could have a blind eye to our inadequacies, which frankly only made things worse. You can love your country, but also want to hold it accountable. Otherwise, you're like a codependent married to an alcoholic.
Could also say that it came together after COVID, although not necessarily in the right way. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like it actually was a huge divider. COVID was a huge divider.
Yeah.
When you had, Republicans, I thought, in the balance, especially in retrospect, had a more balanced approach. Democrats wanted people to hide perennially, meaning that COVID would always be a health issue. And so they were actually the more extremists on that bill. But, yeah, you almost have to go back to 9/11. And then before that, as far as a country that generally was thinking we were heading in the right direction, you just had, you know, a beep with Clinton. I think there was a lot of that in Clinton. And there was a lot of that with Reagan. But it gets more and more scarce when you look closely at it.
Well, that's right. I think, you know, we got things done during Reagan. We got things done during Bush 41. We got things done during Clinton. But in the 21st century, with the exception of the attack on 9/11 and COVID, we really have not worked together in a bipartisan fashion to any significant extent. There are a few exceptions to that, but they are very few. The other thing is that we continue to not learn from history and not learn from other countries. You know, one example is COVID. I mean, we didn't learn from the experience of the Spanish flu in the early 20th century. We didn't shut down the government. We didn't keep kids from going to school. We didn't learn also from other countries, like the Scandinavian countries, as an example. They didn't shut down all their schools. They didn't shut down the economy. And so we're not an island. We need to learn from history. We need to learn from others. All too frequently, what government does is when there's a problem, what's the first thing they do? Throw money at it.
Yep. Yeah, it's easy to do as other people's money, including people that won't be born for decades.
Correct. It's called stewardship. We are failing in our stewardship responsibility to our country and future generations of Americans. That's not right, and I'm trying to change it.
So he. We can go back to our conversation on Musk. He decides to create a third party. I totally agree with you. It's going to have to be a coalition based party. But you said something during the break that is going to be the elephant in the room, which is, what are they going to believe? They got to believe something. They got to have some kind of agenda, and that's where you begin to divide people, right? When you try to define those things.
Well, that's right. I mean, as they say, the devil is in the details, right? I mean, I think what you have to do is you have to pick issues that are of concern to the American people, try to commit to address those issues in a common sense and collaborative approach. You don't necessarily want to get into the weeds, and you don't necessarily need to get into the weeds. Let's face it, in the case of the last presidential election, there were several issues of major concern. You know, one was border security and immigration. The other one was the economy, including inflation. Another one is international stability. Those are three big issues that were of concern to the American people. You can address those issues with, you know, a modest amount of specificity, but you don't have to get too detailed.
Yep. Yeah. And boy, it sounds opaque when we're talking, but really what we're talking about is just a little bit of common sense. You know, and we really should major in the majors and not in the minors. Maybe you have a party. Go ahead.
Right.
Go ahead. You're saying something. Go ahead, David.
No. What I was going to say is what's frustrating to me, Kevin, is, you know, I've done more citizen education engagement than probably anybody in the country, especially with regard to the fiscal issue. And, you know, Washington has the style that, you know, they think they have all the answers. And so they try to come up with proposals in Washington. Then they try to go out and do a sell job on the people. You know, as I said, many of our elected officials here aren't representative of the country in reality with regard to, from an ideological standpoint, from the standpoint of priorities, and even from the standpoint of income and wealth. And so we need to do much more with regard to citizen education engagement to help them understand where we are, where we're headed, how we compare to others, why we must make changes, what will end up happening if we don't make changes, and then what's the path forward? What's the path forward? And what I've always found is, you know, a significant majority of the American people will agree to reasoned and reasonable common sense solutions to a whole range of issues if you engage them in the proper manner. But the current system doesn't do that, and that's got to change.
Yeah, everything from, you know, how congressional districts are cut, you know, shaped.
Correct.
Those are insane. They're designed, you know, to create this animosity. Their little, you know, polarization is built in to that system. And you've got on both parties, like you said, crazy extremists. You got the Democrats who seem to have absolutely no clue on how jobs are created, how what fiscal responsibility looks like, zero idea of what impact regulations have on economies. You have the Republican Party that really kind of comes across like a plutocracy who's trying to get rid of the middle income and below and sees them as riffraff. They got to go. There's got to be a third way. And that becomes a luxury, unfortunately, when you have a two-party system, which, you know, when you factor in the Electoral College, which I used to be a fan of, not so much anymore, you know, and the fact that we don't have a parliamentary system, which I understand checks and balances. That's why we don't have a parliamentary system. But even with our checks and balances, we have incredible extremism. I would almost rather have more plurality than worry about the value of checks and balances, because the checks are out of balance, like they would be in a parliamentary system. So I'm not sure how much it would matter.
Well, let's talk about the political situation. You know, we have 435 House seats. Less than 10% of those are really competitive. You know if a Republican or a Democrat is going to win based on the primary results. And now we have about 50% of registered voters are unaffiliated, like myself. There's a number of states, I think it's about 16, that if you're unaffiliated, you can't vote in the primaries. They're disenfranchised. That's wrong. You know, we need integrated and open primaries. We need to change the redistricting system. So the purpose of redistricting is to maximize the amount of competition consistent with the Voting Rights Act rather than to minimize the amount of competition consistent with the Voting Rights Act. We need to consider campaign finance reform. We need to consider 12-year term limits. You know, a number of these things can be done, you know, at the state level. Some things can be done through federal legislation, but some things require a constitutional amendment. For example, term limits and campaign finance reform will require a constitutional amendment. And I might note that recently the president announced that he was for term limits. But if you think Congress is going to pass it on themselves, you're dreaming. And so if that's going to happen, it's going to happen through a convention of states, which is provided for under Article 5 of the Constitution.
Yeah, Trump would like term limits for anyone other than him. If he could get rid of that limit on him, he'd be glad to do it. He even played with that idea, as you well know, until it became very obvious that he was going to expend even to him, he doesn't mind expending political capital. I'm sure you've observed most politicians are a little more calculating, which I think is smart. But even he said, yeah, this is getting me nowhere. I'll let the boys take over, you know, his VP or his Secretary of State. God, it's so weird. It's so weird listening to him talk about something as sacred as our institutions. But anyway, great conversation. Your advice, if you had a chance to chat with Elon Musk about this.
Well, my advice is similar to what we said before. I think we do need more competition. I think a fulcrum strategy makes a lot of sense. By that, I mean the margins are so close in the House and the Senate between the two parties. If we can elect enough persons who are dedicated to work in a common sense, constructive and cooperative manner, focused on some of the real key issues that this country needs to address that it's failed to address, employing a partnership approach with No Labels and other, you know, organizations, including the Ford Party, targeting on a handful of Senate races and maybe 10 or 12 House races, that could be a very effective game-changing strategy. And you've got time to do that for the midterms in 2026. The separate issue is whether or not you want to create a full party to be able to run, in many, many more races at different levels of government. That's a whole different situation. I think we need to focus on 2026 right now and a targeted strategy.
Yeah, I think so. I think you have to build to get to a nationwide strategy. And cutting straight to that, you know, in 2016, frankly, the Libertarian Party candidates, Gary Johnson on the top of the ticket, one of the most successful governors in the history of New Mexico. Yes, he's weird, he's kind of a gadfly. But of the candidates, the Libertarian Party, with the former governor of Massachusetts as the VP and Gary Johnson as the presidential candidate, was the most credible, in my opinion, of the three parties, of those three parties. And you see how he did, what, less than 5%? It's shocking to me. And so we really have to take a concentrated approach where parties won't matter as much. And I think that's probably in the House and the Senate, certainly not in the big race. Whereas you pointed out before, the institutional barriers for running for president for third parties are beyond belief.
Yeah, and the parties, believe me, don't like competition.
They don't.
We shouldn't be surprised. I mean, I guess that's kind of human nature, right? I mean, they think the current system works to their advantage. You're either with them or you're against them, and there's nothing in between.
Yeah, I sure wish we could find statesmen, though, who would go above self-interest. But you're right. I mean, if they're just crass, self-interested individuals who put partisanship and winning over the country's interest, yeah, I think you're right. And that's all part of the sad testimony that there's this country today, I'm afraid. Chats with you. Go ahead.
Thanks, Kevin. I was going to say there are a few exceptions, but there's not enough exceptions. You know, we've got too many people that have duty of loyalty to their country, to their party rather than duty of loyalty to their country. Too many politicians that are focused on today, the next election, rather than the next generation. And that's one of the reasons that we're at risk. We can turn it around, and it's important that we do it sooner rather than later.
Well, in the last decade, the ones you're referring to who do put country first have become an endangered species. They have either been ousted, or they have retired because they can't stand the environment anymore, and I don't blame them. And so, yeah, it really has to change. David, give your website. The Honorable David Walker, always love having you on the program. Your website one more time.
AmericaIn2040.com.
Yeah, absolutely. Check it out. I'm Kevin Price. This is the nationally syndicated Price of Business. Stay tuned for more after this.
That wraps up another Price of Business. I am glad to be with you. Really enjoyed it and enjoying our new home here on these stations around the country. I do want to remind you that the show continues 24/7. Not only do we have this weekly show that you can hear on this station, but we're on other stations around the country with a daily program as well. You can easily learn about them by visiting us at priceofbusiness.com. We affectionately say it is the show that never ends. And what we mean by that is that it continues 24/7 with the addition of new audio, video, articles, and more at priceofbusiness.com. While there, we'd like you to engage with us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Kevin Price Live and all of our sister sites as well. All right, I'm going to take a break until next time. Next week, we'll be back with you with much more information for you, and look forward to that conversation. And I want to say, again, thank you to USA Business Radio to make it possible for this to have been commercial-free, an entire hour of commercial-free. And guess what? Even more commercial-free than public radio. So we're excited about that. Enjoy the rest of your day right here on this station.